Hey, it's Brian Cook, your host here. Wanted to let you know we now have t-shirts. Would you like to support the podcast? Have you noticed that I can't get a sponsor because this show's too filthy? Hey, it'd be great if some people ordered shirts. They're great looking shirts. Go to estoymerchandise.com, E-S-T-O-Y merchandise.com. You'll find competitive erotic fanfiction on the right hand side. Click on that and you can order shirts. There's men's and women's sizes. It's a great design by my buddy Mark Palm in Seattle. He does all of our amazing poster art. Please support the podcast. It would help us out a ton. That's estoymerchandise.com. E-S-T-O-Y merchandise.com.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 128 of the Competitive Erotic Fanfiction Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Cook, and you've found the internet's number one most trusted source for Muppet boners and horny loners. Got some upcoming shows tomorrow. June 21st is the third anniversary in Los Angeles. That is a championship edition, and it is free at the Virgil doors at 7:30. June 29th at Union Hall in Brooklyn. That show will sell out. Get your tickets, unionhall.com. July 8th, live at North Bar in Chicago. July 9th, Bloomington at the Comedy Attic. July 10th and 11th, you can see me opening for Ian Carmel, frequent competitor Ian Carmel. That's going to be great. And then July 12th, I'll be headlining in Indianapolis. I do not know the name of the venue yet, but I'll get that. You can follow me on Twitter for more details and all of that, at Brian Cooking. But today's show was recorded June 14th, way back in 2013, when the Just for Laughs Festival still existed in Chicago. This is a short one, and the recorder fucked up in the middle, so you're going to hear us come in toward the beginning of Michelle Buteau's story. You'll still know what's going on. And other than that, you're going to hear Ben Roy, Mike Burns, and Mike Stanley in round one, reading pieces they wrote in advance. And then you're going to hear Kyle Kinane, Ben Kronberg, and Johnny Pemberton writing pieces in round two. They wrote backstage, reading pieces they wrote backstage. I'm not going to edit that. I don't have time. Enjoy the show.
Watch the show. All you need to know is that they don't call them zombies. They call them walkers for some reason. That'll be key. All right, here we go. Blonde, independent, bitchy Andrea had become separated from her traveling companions when the farm they had spent several months at was overrun with walkers in the middle of the night. Alone in the woods, she nearly lost her life when she tripped over something while trying to outrun a really fast zombie and was saved at the last minute by a mysterious sword-wielding African-American woman, Michonne. Michonne appeared out of nowhere at the exact moment that the season happened to end, and in one stroke decapitated both walkers who were about to make a sinewy, aging, yet still weirdly hot meal out of Andrea. Michonne was butch as fuck. She never smiled except that one time when she bonded with Carl, but that scene comes much later in season three when we all hoped that she was just about to decapitate him, but instead she helps him retrieve a picture that his parents for some reason left hanging up in a bar. It's never explained why, whatever, let's forget that he should be dead now, because how the fuck do able-bodied men die and Carl manages to survive for three seasons, and for what? Is Herschel's blonde daughter, who like all his daughters bears no resemblance to either him or their mothers, ever gonna fuck Carl? She's smoking hot and he's like 9. And before you get weird, she's 24 in real life, not 17 like on the show, so pipe down. Anyway, Michonne was built like a sexy kickboxer and had dreadlocks that, even though this was post-apocalyptic Georgia, looked like they probably didn't even smell too bad. She was also hot, but in a mean way. Like if you did it with her, she might bite you or punch your dick or something. Andrea and Michonne took to each other immediately and before long had set up camp in an old meat locker, which I assume was supposed to symbolize vaginas and strong women. Like, they're in a meat locker, but it's also a womb because whatever. It didn't take long before both of them realized that the other one was kind of a lesbian, even though Andrea bangs most of the scummiest men she can find, including almost Merle, who probably had a butt plug attachment for his stump. Again, I digress. They did all kinds of cool lesbian shit, but somehow lately their lovemaking had grown stale. So on one particular morning, Michonne had an idea. She roused the sleeping Andrea, took her hand and said, "Follow me." The two exited the meat locker and ramshackle building that surrounded it and went out into the dim early daylight, fully nude. Andrea started to protest, feeling exposed in more ways than one, until she noticed Michonne had brought her sword, which set her mind at ease. Michonne led Andrea away from the building and over to the makeshift hitching post where she kept her travel companions tied up at night. Michonne, you see, had figured out long ago that if she sliced off the jaws and arms of a pair of walkers and led them around on chains, they would not only cloak her scent to the other undead, but she could use them as pack mules. The fact that they were African-American made a lot of white viewers uncomfortable because they totally seem like slaves. But that's beside the point. Michonne had an idea. As she and Andrea approached the zombie slaves, she unsheathed her sword and in one motion sliced off both sets of legs at the knee. The decomposing manservants at once fell on their backs, hissing and gnashing to the best of their armless, legless, jawless abilities. Michonne looked at Andrea and said, "They don't have jaws or teeth, but they've still got tongues." Without hesitation, she proceeded to straddle the face of one walker and grind its hissing maw with her Nubian salami omelet. Andrea immediately followed suit because there's no way it was the first time she'd thought about fucking one of these things. It just took Michonne's brutal ingenuity to determine how to do so safely. The undead tongues lapped feverishly as the girls' respective nether regions, and the writhing of the limbless torsos only added to the pleasure, and the girls each climaxed multiple times. "Hey, at least they can't complain about the smell," said Andrea, who hadn't showered since they left that stupid, boring farm. Michonne got carried away, and in the midst of one particularly strong orgasm, literally crushed her partner's fragile skull with a powerful thrust. It burst like a moldy cantaloupe full of month-old borscht. Far from satisfied and highly aroused by watching Andrea ride the face of her still-functioning necromantic partner, Michonne, in a depraved act of sexual desperation, crawled over to Andrea's partner, tore off his pants, and without hesitation took his flaccid cock into her mouth. She tried to ignore the fact that it tasted like a combination of kimchi and swamp rot as she sucked away in a futile attempt to erect the necrotic member. Andrea had been distracted until now, but the slurping sounds got her attention. She looked over her shoulder to see Michonne with a mouthful of flaccid, rotting walker cock and immediately threw up, which ruined the moment for both of the girls, but not the zombie who was now kind of into it. "What the fuck, Michonne?" she sputtered as she snapped to her feet and spun around. Michonne looked up at Andrea and froze like a raccoon caught in a flashlight beam while eating a rotting banana out of a garbage can. She let the decaying monster Johnson flop out of her mouth without breaking eye contact with her former friend. Neither of them spoke for a second, and then Michonne arose slowly, retrieved her sword, and drove the blade deep into the skull of the one remaining walker. The two turned and walked, naked and in silence, back toward the meat locker. And then Michonne finally spoke. "Look, it was bound to happen eventually." "No, it wasn't!" Andrea fucking lied. "You never thought about it?" "Not even for a second!" she lied again. Awkward silence again befell the pair, and then Michonne had a thought. "Hey, wait a minute. You did let one of those freaks eat you out. Don't, like, act like you're better than me, you fucking honky bitch." And then she cut off Andrea's head, which totally solved most of the problems that would have befallen Rick and Herschel's group later in the season. The end. All right. Ben, you got those suggestions for me, buddy? Yeah. And let's bring to the stage the round two comics who will be writing based upon your suggestions. Ladies and gentlemen, big round of applause for Johnny Pemberton, Ben Kronberg, and Kyle Kinane. All right, so here's how this part works. We're going to start with Johnny. Johnny, step up to the mic. Round of applause for Johnny Pemberton.
Hello.
If he likes the first suggestion, he can just take it and run with it. If he doesn't like it, I'll draw a second one, but then you guys vote with applause based on which one you wanted to write. So that is a terrible suggestion.
Oh, wow. Wait, can I know?
Bat. The Simpsons. How do you feel about the Simpsons?
It's just so obvious. I feel like it's been. I'll take a second.
We'll
I'll
go
try
for a second,
second.
One. All right.
Johnny's not that I. Just like I don't. You know.
Too specific. Too specific.
Too specific. I like specific.
Muppet Babies.
Oh.
So I leave it to you. Who would like to hear The Simpsons? Literally no one, not even the person that suggested it. Who would like to hear Muppet Babies?
Yeah.
Yes. You sick fucks. All right, Johnny Pemberton, keep it going for Kyle Kinane, ladies and gentlemen. Keep it going for Kyle Kinane, ladies and gentlemen. There it is. Comedy show.
I hope one of these is Mayor McCheese, because I just thought of something.
I don't know what part of this you guys didn't understand, but time travel / big butts. It's not...
I want to do that one.
Of course you do. Your first option is the Vampire Diaries. How do you feel about a show I'm sure you've never seen and probably haven't heard of? For teenagers.
No.
All right. Your second option is Family Matters. So, who wants to hear Vampire Diaries? You guys are all on board. All right, Family Matters it is. Kyle Kinane, ladies and gentlemen.
Sponsored by State Farm, everybody.
State Farm Insurance. Give it over Ben Kronberg.
And then some more.
And then some more. I don't know if this is a real thing. You guys are going to have to tell me. Street Sharks? Yeah. What is it?
An old cartoon from the 80s.
Okay. How do you feel about Street Sharks?
I think it's fucking stupid.
All right, that's enough.
Sorry, I just don't know what it is.
All right, let's take another one. Well, we already got that. Muppets, but we're already doing it. The movie Blank Check. That's fucking awesome. Street Sharks? Who wants to hear Street Sharks? Again, you guys all on board. I like it. Blank Check? All right, Ben Kronberg with Blank Check. Thanks, buddy. We'll see you guys in a little bit. And please welcome your...
Only toilet in the house flush and yells, Archie, are you hungry? Because she knows her man works up a bigot-sized appetite. Archie quickly replies, when are you gonna die, Edith? Then she yells, Gloria, are you hungry, dear? We faintly hear Gloria yell, Ma, I had enough to eat. Meanwhile, Gloria, who's in her 20s, is in her room that she slept in since she can remember, on her twin-sized bed with a pink and white canopy, doing a line of cocaine off her husband's dick. She laughs so hard that she starts to snort like a fat pig. Her husband, Michael, is laying naked on the single bed with his hairy feet hanging off and a Lucha Libre mask on his face, reading the same black-on-black crime magazine with Grace Jones on the front. Gloria gets off her knees, and we see that she's wearing the same purple penis number that Grace is wearing on the White Stallion. She whimpers, oh, Michael, you know belts make me look fat. He says through his mask, Gloria, you'll never be fat to me. You'll always be a goddess. He grabs her round face and they kiss gently through the Lucha Libre mask and he fondles her big purple dick belt. It's almost too perfect because they both like Prince too. Archie, Gloria, and Michael all make their way downstairs to the family room. Michael, who's always testing his father-in-law's limits, sits down in his oversized reclining chair. Archie quickly finds a newspaper and slaps his oversized head with it. Get up, meathead. You can sit here when you start paying bills and when I'm dead. Mike gets up slowly, not to be an asshole, because his 70s Wrangler jeans are too tight and his ass is sore from all the purple penis action. Gloria kisses her father on his balding, salty head and says, oh, Daddy, it's America's birthday. It's a great day. This is the happiest Gloria's ever been. It's almost like she knew she was never going to be that hot again and be forced to do an adopted African kid for 10-cent infomercials. Archie scowls, America's the greatest place, please. They're all coming over here and taking our jobs. Michael, who's very offended, still high in cocaine, chimes in. Now, Archie, you know everyone should have equal rights. Edith bursts in the family room with a tray of beer and overly processed pork products to save the day and exclaims, now, now, everybody, I've got a tray of hors d'oeuvres. They're delicious. As Edith puts down her tray, her zipper is struggling to keep her overly processed lady meat parts together. I'm hungry. The family's in the backyard getting ready for the barbecue, and Archie and Michael grab patio furniture and start rearranging it. Gloria and Edith are fixing snacks and white lights everywhere. Gloria, who is still coked out of her mind, is talking her mom's ear off about her friends, dreams, and aspirations, and about a singer named Prince who she's grown fond of. Edith is so happy that someone's not yelling at her. She's just smiling and nodding. Archie and Mike open up the large patio umbrella to set it in the middle of the table, but the pins become loose and the umbrella closes them in, sucking them in together. Archie and Michael are now face to face. They've never been this close before. Archie's breath smells like cigars and homophobia. Michael's breath smells like pork products and Gloria's glory hole. Archie's confused and old and starts yelling for Edith, Edith, but she can't hear him because she smells too bad. Mike takes his chance to try and humanize Archie. He gently brushes his forearms. Archie's dick jumps a little bit. He has no idea what he's feeling inside. Was this last night's meatloaf? No, it was something else. Mike leans in gently the only way he can while he's stuck in an umbrella, and he pecks Archie on the lips. Archie's eyes are wide open, confused. Mike goes in again, this time with a little tongue. Mike then takes Archie's hands and puts it on his fully erect dick. He could tell Archie is scared. Mike whispers, "You don't call me meathead for nothing." They passionately start making out. Then all of a sudden, the umbrella goes up, and they're so wrapped up in their moment, they don't even see or hear the girls running over to them in panic. Edith trips over her feet while running as she falls and lands at their feet. Her dress lets the dogs out. Just white, drooping, National Geographic titties everywhere. Economy-sized pink areolas and blue veins to match. Her tits are so big she could breastfeed one of Gloria's future African kids from America. Edith's vintage muffin top gets Mike all even more excited. He nestles his head between her legs and starts flossing with her puss hair. Archie's just confused, and he's just horny and standing over them in his wife beater and his droopy underwear, jerking off, saying, "When girls were girls and men were men!" Gloria is just in a tizzy, so confused, she goes and reaches for Archie's salty head. She's like, "Dad, what is going on? What's happening?" He lifts her shirt and gently cups her perfect breast and says, "Happy Independence Day." She's like, "You're my daddy. What are you doing?" He's like, "I'm not your father." Then he bends her over and strips her high-waisted jeans off of her and fucks her. They all take turns, fucking each other, sucking each other. Fireworks start to fill the sky with smoke, lights, color, and wonder. And that Independence Day, that's how they kept it all in the family.
Michelle Buteau, ladies and gentlemen. Keep it going for Mike Burns.
Hey, this is Guy Fieri, and we're rolling out. Searching for America's greatest diners, drive-ins, and dives. This trip, late-night grub spots, like in Bay City, Michigan, where they're putting a new twist on French toast made from scratch. In a joint that happens to be run by two wholesome librarian types, but have interestingly large breasts. We'll also be checking out another spot in Muncie, Indiana, where a lonely blonde woman, who may or may not be crazed with a thirst for man juice, is serving up sandwiches piled high with toppings you might not expect. Cut to a stupid-looking woman eating a Reuben sandwich topped with whipped cream.
"We eat here every Sunday. The whipped cream Reuben is to die for."
Or another place in Chicago, Illinois, where the pancakes just keep coming and coming and coming and coming, with 37 different kinds. Also, the owner looks like she needs something thick and veiny shoved in every one of her holes. It's all right here, right now, on Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. Bloom, bloom, bloom. We see Guy Fieri cruising in his red Camaro at night with his sunglasses on. It's not very safe, and he hits a few parked cars. Now, if you've been watching Triple D, you know that I'm a French toast maniac with a side of sausage. So when I heard that Sloppy's Grill in Bay City, Michigan was throwing down some of the most righteous French toast this side of the Mississippi, I just had to check it out. Plus, I needed a break from driving due to a serious case of road boner. swear my meat wouldn't quit spitting up clear bubbles of pre-cum with every bump on the road. And it's tough as hell to get a smooth stroke going on my bold flavor flesh whip while I'm trying to work the stick shift on my 67 Camaro. So I thought it'd be best to pull into Sloppy's for a couple nose candy key bumps in their John before giving myself a quick tug job into their urinal. And after I worked up an appetite from shooting a thick and nasty white gob, then it'd be time to try their French toast. Sloppy's is owned by two nerdy-looking chicks who'd be hot with their glasses off. Because we can see how thick and juicy their barely legal cans are due to their low-cut waitress tops and skirts. Also, one of them bent over and I noticed that she forgot to wear panties that day. When I saw it, I could feel my man bacon get extra crispy. Also, I don't know what either of the girls' names are because who cares? Let's just call the blonde one Candy and the black one Sweet Cocoa. What I do know is they're doing everything from French toast topped with chili, cut to some overweight guy who looks like he rolled in a wheelbarrow.
Oh, look, the large portions.
To deep-fried burritos filled with cheesecake and pizza. Cut to some idiot college dipshit with his dirty baseball hat on backwards.
Sloppy's is just the best. I always come here after night of hanging out with friends.
To their specialty, a whole in-house slow-roasted Thanksgiving turkey stuffed with French toast and syrup that they're calling turkey toast. We cut to a shot of a whole turkey being rubbed in their special mixture of secret spices. Candy has bent over, and we can see her wet cookie peek out of her shorts to say hello again. This catches Guy Fieri's eye. He takes off his sunglasses, puts them on the back of his head, spits in his hand, and then slowly shoves it down the front of his cargo shorts. First, the bird's rubbed in their special mixture of secret spices. Then it's popped in the smoker overnight for an added layer of... Oh, fuck. Oh, fuck. It's fuck. Oh, shit. Shit. Guy spills a massive hot load of sex mayonnaise. And there's no hiding it this time. His knees quiver and his eyes roll back in his head as his front tail pushes out two more bursts of white dick diarrhea. It's completely understandable from the amount of sack sauce that pools into his flip-flops that he needed that release like ham needs cheese. And it could have been a life or death situation if his fat, spiky, blonde balls got any fuller. What the fuck, said Candy? Yeah, what the fuck, says Sweet Cocoa? Sorry, ladies, but I've been on the road all day with a throbber in my shorts gurgling with gooey gack. And when I saw Candy's pink beef slit wink at me, I didn't have any choice but to drain my boiled potatoes. No, Candy said, exhausted by Guy's endless sexual euphemisms. We meant, what the fuck? Why'd you waste your hard cock and cum, you stupid fat fuck? Why the fuck did you think I didn't wear any underwear today? I showed you my pussy to let you know that we were both down to have a threesome. Not so you could just beat your dick off like a stupid, retarded pig boy. Looks like Coco's gonna have to teach you a lesson, you porky bitch. Sweet Coco removed her skirt to reveal a beautiful black tranny cock. Not too big, but definitely enough to do some damage on a middle-aged man's virgin asshole. Sweet Coco is the kind of tranny you watch in porn videos sometimes and lie to yourself about not being into because she just looks like a super hot black chick that happens to have a dick. And who knows, you might be into that. So it wouldn't hurt to beat off in your hotel room here in Chicago as research for that competitive erotic fan fiction story you're doing while you're writing about Guy Fieri. So anyway, back to the story. Guy bit his lip at the sight of it. I'm not into that homo shit, he mumbled as he shifted his line of sight to the floor, nervously moving his toes around and the semen slowly thickening in his flops. Guy's crotch told another story as his dong awoke from its brief slumber, obviously enticed by Sweet Coco's smooth, dark erection. It was the first one he'd seen in person since football camp in the 10th grade when Coach Titleman joined the team in the showers. He thought about that day a lot, more than he'd like to admit. Candy walked over and unbuttoned Guy's cargo shorts, pulling them to the ground along with his novelty Tabasco boxers. And began slowly stroking his reddish-tan shaft. Guy's cock was as thick as you might expect. Thicker, even. Not long, but thick as a can of cream corn, to be sure. Now, Candy whispered as she slowly pushed him to his knees, you're gonna get down on your hands and knees like a good little pig boy, aren't you? Aren't you? She screamed as she slapped his ruddy face. Yes, ma'am, Guy said. He smiled awkwardly as a solitary tear dripped down his cheek. It was a show of relief, that tear. Then he slipped a thumb in his mouth and started sucking on it with the innocence of anyone about to have their first time. Seconds felt like hours as Sweet Coco doused Guy's bleach blonde anus with olive oil and then slowly inserted herself past the point of no return. Guy squealed like a piggy squeal and was quickly told to shut up by Candy as she stomped on his hand. As Sweet Coco's piston-like thrust taught Guy Fieri the ultimate lesson in the pleasure of pain. He had a moment of clarity. What the fuck have I been doing? I'm a fucking clown. Everybody knows it. I fucking hate myself. Sweet Coco's hips started to buck and Guy knew what was next. Take me to Flavortown, he moaned as he swung around, mouth open like a beggar, and starved to taste his own ass mixed with Sweet Coco's black hog juice. After Guy Fieri drained every last drop with his lips, Candy took him in her arms on the floor and held him as he wept. Running her hands through his hair, she said, everything's gonna be all right. You're mama's little pig boy now. And slowly guided him down to suckle on her comforting bosom. Guy drifted off to sleep. And for once, in sense he couldn't remember, Guy Fieri didn't wish he was dead. We'll see you next time on Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives.
My favorite part of that was how appalled Michelle Buteau was the whole time after she wrote nothing but incest. Let's give it over Mike Stanley, ladies and gentlemen.
Night courting. The image of a giant greasy dick flashes like lightning, and with that Marky awoke, gasping for air. Panic. She lay there hyperventilating. Her eyes were open, but other than the light shining through the window, she was not yet able to bring the room into focus. Her eyes stung and were caked with clots of mascara, blue eyeshadow, and a substance similar to pie crust. Ugh! My head is ringing like a bell, she thought, as she swallowed hard and felt the familiar acidity associated with cocaine use in her sinus cavity. What did I do last night, she thought, as the headache began to set in. I don't remember a thing. She chuckled a bit. She lay there dazed, and for a few moments, And for the next few moments, she began piecing together the last 24 hours. What's the last thing I do remember? Flashback. She's standing in a courtroom on set. Cut! That's a wrap! The director yells from a bullhorn, and the cast and crew all begin to applaud. Wait, wait, wait! And to our newest cast member, congratulations to Marky Post, or should I say, public defender Christine Sullivan. The cast and crew explode into applause, woos, and whistles. Marky curtsies and even begins to blush a little. They love her. We love her. She's smart and sexy. Her ivory white silk jumper and giant shoulder pads accentuate her tiny waist. Her silk low-cut V-neck reveals just enough cleavage to give you the impression that the rest of those yabos are so perfect, the mere thought of them would send a rush of blood to the limpest of pork nozzles. Yes, well done, Marky, Harry Anderson says, as he stands up behind his elevated judge's bench, towering over everyone else with his gavel raised. Now, if anyone needs me, I'll be in my chambers. Harry then proceeds to act out walking down a spiral staircase behind his desk until he disappears like an asshole. All right.
right, thank you, everyone, says the director. We'll see you at tonight's big after party. You know, when they said a situational comedy about a Manhattan courtroom filled with eccentric characters, zero regard for sexual harassment, and the glue holding the whole thing together is a judge who oftentimes interjects unnecessary magic into a verdict would never make it on television, I thought, hogwash! And look at us now, another hilarious episode in the can. Speaking of getting it in the can... Suddenly, before Marky knew what was happening, her hand was caught in an embrace, and someone was kissing it. Her eyes were now locked with the man standing in front of her. It was John Larroquette. He was wearing a charcoal-colored three-piece suit. He was sharp-tongued and devilishly not handsome. He leaned in and spoke, this time in a whisper. Those turd cutters could drop a cocoa fart bar into my gazpacho. And the only peep you'd hear out of me is, may I have seconds? Listen, I loved your work on The Fall Guy. I've got a few extra tickets to see Wham! This weekend. And my Fiero just got a fresh coat of wax. So if you're interested, what do you say I pick you up? Cool it, Larroquette! A stern, authoritative voice rang out to Marky's aid from nowhere. There'll be enough action for you at tonight's after party. You leave this nice girl alone. It was Marshall Warfield. Circling around Marky and flanking on the other side was Richard Mall, whom everyone called Bull on and off set. Marsha and Bull were always together because stereotypes. John raises both hands in an I give up motion and begins to walk backwards towards the double doors of the courtroom. Hey, hey, easy, Marsha. John backed off because he was a rich white pussy and afraid of black people. Just trying to welcome our new friend to the Big Apple is all. John slips in a quick wink to Marky and then vanishes through the courtroom doors. What a scumbag, Marky thought. Marky was glad someone broke the discomfort of the situation, but she could have handled it on her own. She was sexy, but she had a fierce side, a dangerous side, too. Marky's focus shifts towards Marsha. Her eyes say thank you. Sugar, don't you pay no mind to him. That sleazeball would put his dick in a beehive, given the chance. And you are beautiful. Let me get a look at you, girl. Marky was beautiful, her perfectly feathered hair shimmering so ethereal in the stage lights a thousand eagles would have fought and died to fuck it given the chance. Come on, girl, you're gonna love this after party. Stick with us, and the three of them locked arms and went away. Moments later, the cast found themselves in a giant stretch limo provided by NBC. And on their way, everyone was describing to what was to be the biggest after party of the year. Let's hear it for the boys, played at full volume. Everyone was drinking top-shelf liquor. Marky was drinking, too, but she was new and couldn't help but feel a bit out of place. Harry could sense the sitting next to her. He yells over the music. Marky, embrace it! You're young, beautiful, you're on a hit TV show. It's 1984, and we're barely thinking about AIDS. Harry was right, Marky thought. Not just about AIDS, but the other stuff, too. This was it. This was her time to let loose, show her wild side, to accept her newfound fame. She was in New York. It was the center of the universe. Or at least that's what everyone in New York told her every 3 seconds. She was amongst friends. It's time to let her guard down. You're right, Harry. Of course I'm right. He then dropped a tiny pill into the last half of Marky's Bartles and James wine cooler. It's a Quaalude. You'll love it. Now let's make some magic. Okay, she said, and as she smiled and guzzled the last of her drink, Harry then proceeded to do shitty magic in the limo for the remainder of the ride. Marky, laying in bed, now remembers, that's where everything went haywire. The second that Quaalude hit my tongue. That was no ordinary after party. She began to feel the tension that something awful had happened. But what? They arrived at the party. Max said the secret password, breakdancing, into the slot... into the slot of the iron door, and it slides open. The cast members enter what looked to be an abandoned building and walk down a seemingly endless corridor. Every step, the music getting louder. The effects of the Quaalude now taking hold. Marky starts to feel loose. They reach a giant black curtain. Sunglasses at Night by Corey Hart is playing so loud it drowns out all other sounds. Well, here we go, Bull says. With a smile as he pulls back the curtain, revealing what's behind it. It blows her fucking mind. It's a giant circular room draped in red velvet. Giant New trapeze artists swing from the ceiling. To her left is the cast of Santa Barbara, surrounded by topless Jezebels and a giant tray of cocaine. Above the bar, Lonnie Anderson and Burt Reynolds are relaxing in a giant fish tank as though it's their personal bathtub. They're sipping champagne. Lonnie is wearing nothing but her tan lines, and Burt is wearing only his cowboy hat, a sterling silver cock ring decorated with chunks of amethyst and turquoise stones bigger than his balls, which seem to be a hit with a school of clownfish sharing the tank, now nipping at his hog. To the left is Ralph Macchio. He's soaking wet, wearing nothing but whitey tighties and the headband from Karate Kid. A small crowd of shirtless mustache muscle men surround him. They're all greased up as he explains and acts out the crane kick. There isn't a soft, dry dong among them. And right at the mouth of the entrance is a nude Salman Rushdie eating a piece of cake. His dinky pecker, low-slung balls, and flip-flops gross her out. But his cherubic face and welcome, come join us gesture suggests otherwise. People are everywhere. Marsha Warfield immediately pops her top and yells, "Don't mind if I do, sugar," and makes a beeline for Nell Carter, who is wearing nipple clamps, leather chaps, and holding a leash attached to a dog collar worn by an old white man blindfolded on all fours. They embrace and kiss immediately. Holy shit, that was an industry fuckfest, Marky thought as she lay in bed freaking out. Her mind is now flashing blips of not only other people's sexual activity, but her own. Bits and pieces of information set to music flood her. Her flutter head weaving together a tapestry of reckless drug use and sexual behavior, which lead her to her current state. She remembers snorting cocaine off Tom Selleck's mustache, then Frenching aggressively to Prince's Let's Go Crazy. She remembers thunder hammering her muff onto the thigh of Jan Michael Vincent from the hit show Airwolf as they sexily dance to Rockwell's Somebody's Watching Me. Back in bed, Marky begins to panic. Oh, God, what have I done? How could I be so loose and cheap? This is a nightmare. She remembers watching David Copperfield fisting two women's assholes at the same time and producing doves from each, yelling, "Illusions!" She remembers Harry looking sad as he watched and admired how well the trick was executed. The room is spinning. More cocaine. More Quaaludes. A dash of Huey Lewis. Dry humping Don Johnson spider style on the toilet as he talked about starting a music career. Alf and E.T. were 69ing as the theme from Ghostbusters played. A quick flash of her receiving missionary by a faceless man. Andy Warhol painting three dicks on three different dicks. Oh, God! She realized she was naked in her bed. More panic, more heart pounding. Saxophones, magic, sweat, lace, synthesizers, heart racing, Phil Collins. How did she get back here? Just then the toilet flushes in her apartment. Reality sets in. Someone is here. But who could it be now? Was it Tom? Don? Airwolf? Her eyes begin to focus, and with each breath she notices several curly salt and pepper colored hairs dancing on her pillow. She turns over, and as she does, the bathroom door swings open. John Larroquette! He's wearing her panties and a bathrobe and smoking a cigarette. No! She screams. Well, public defender Sullivan, he says with one hand on the front of those satin pink panties as he rustles his hand around like he's massaging a baby ferret. Who's ready for round 14? Marky sits there emotionless, her eyes well up, and one thought races through her head. I used to fuck Lee Majors. The end. Thank you.
Mike Stanley. Keep it going for your final first round. Competitor Ben Roy. Keep it going for your final.
Thank you. What's eating Gilbert Grape? Did you hear the rest of this? A disheveled and grimy Leonardo DiCaprio hangs tethered and teetering from a steel ladder welded to the south stilt of a water tower springing up from the center of a small Texas town. All right, let's try this again, everyone called young director Lars Hallstrom From the white hydro monolith, Leo begins awkwardly rolling his head back and forth, to and fro, and darting his eyes as if afflicted by a dubious cocktail of potential brain and traumatic spine injuries. Say when's Audie, Gilbert? Say when's Audie? Leonardo calls down to the nubile Johnny Depp. Jesus fucking Christ, Lars, are you serious? Johnny complained. What the fuck is supposed to be wrong with him? I thought he was retarded, not huffing paint. This is just insulting. I know, JD. Maybe you could give him some pointers. No, absolutely not. I'm one of the most talented actors of all time. I mean, look at the way I don't tie my boots when I'm in public. For fuck's sake, just look at this brimmed hat and not really tinted enough to block the sun, but too dark to be regular glasses, sunglasses. I'm clearly above this amateur garbage. I'll let you star in that piece of shit Don Juan DeMarco so you can spend 6 months on an island with Marlon Brando and maybe get a chance to suckle from a real actor's tits. Fine, Johnny Depp signed. Tell him to meet me at my place in 1 hour. Great, I really appreciate this, Lars said excitedly. Cut! That's a wrap for the day. Let's get Leo down. Damn it! Really? Leo exclaimed. I was just about to shit my pants and then try to catch a bird and eat it. You know, some real mentally handicapped method type shit. Yeah, no, you're doing fine. It's just the light's wrong or whatever. You go see Johnny in his trailer. He wants to talk to you. Oh, well. All right, then, Lars. I'll go see him in his trailer, Leonardo said, before jamming his finger in his nose, pissing himself a little, and commencing with his most degrading impression yet. Meanwhile, back in his private yurt, Johnny Depp lay prostrate, cloaked in a gown woven from the rarest muga silk and bound together by Sudanese orphan wishes. Snacking on rare rocks and pebbles and a charcoal-hued beanbag made completely of dried African elephant scrotums and filled with Pacific abalone pearls, Johnny perused a faded copy of Finnegan's Wake that nestled in his ring-festooned fingers. He didn't quite understand what the hell the book was about, but he knew it to be one of the most pretentious books of all time, and so would often place it in front of his face and then daze off until unexpected company or paparazzi arrived. It was just at this moment that Johnny lowered his book, the overwhelming waft of urine and feces beginning to permeate his compartment. What the fuck is that? He exclaimed. Just then there was a knock at the door. A muffled voice from the other side exclaimed, Say who's at the door, Gilbert! Say who's at the door! Jesus, Johnny said to himself. Not wanting any of the cast and crew to observe the spectacle waiting outside, Johnny snapped open the door, pulled the soiled Leo in, and slammed it back shut. It was just then that Johnny realized that along with letting Leo in, he had also welcomed in the cacophony of mephitic vapors that trailed Leonardo as if he were a fully grown and culturally insensitive pig pen from Peanuts. Hey, Gilbert! Leonardo shouted in Johnny Depp's face. God damn, you smell like summer in Mumbai, Johnny Depp gasped. When was the last time you showered? Well, Gilbert, I haven't bathed in 6 months, and I haven't washed this. Leonardo raised a bony black index finger that was covered in a foul Darwinian dropout demi-glaze of snot, feces, and earth. I haven't washed this since I found out I was getting this part over 1 year ago. Wow, whatever. We need to get you to be a bit more subtle. No retarded person would ever act like that, Johnny scolded. I want you to try an acting exercise. I want you to step out of acting like Arnie. Let's start with another prosecuted group, something requiring a little more sensitivity. How about homosexuals? Maybe you could try being a homosexual, you know, and they shower. Maybe you could do that first. Leo, excited to be working with such an accomplished actor, immediately stopped for a moment, closed his eyes, shook from head to toe, then slowly raised his gaze upon his new prey. Johnny knew the look of pure fucklust that now crossed his naive co-star's eyes. He had seen it in his previous lover's eyes as well as every other male and female on the planet. Oh, shit. Wait, Johnny Depp tried to pause, but it was too late. Leonardo leapt at his newfound object of affection, pummeling his arms and completely restraining his limbs about his body. This isn't how homosexuals act, Johnny Depp cried, his voice cracking. It is at San Quentin, Leonardo said in an oddly Spanish accent. I'm a bull queer and I'm ready to fuck milkweed. San Quentin, Johnny gulped. Leonardo quickly shredded Johnny's prized Muga silk and orphan wish bathrobe and bent him over the antique leopard bone coffee table centered in the middle of the yurt, exposing Johnny's milky, whiskerless nook ends and pristinely creased shit divot. Shredding off his soiled corduroys and stained mommy's little prize ironic novelty shirt, Leonardo exposed his tiny pecs, hard abs, and 5 inches of dirt and urine-dappled thump knob. Johnny breathed a sigh of relief when in the reflection of his prized mirror made from a highly polished section of Princess Di's accident vehicle, he caught a glimpse of Leo's mediocre-sized howl hammer that appeared to be much like his tormentor's acting skills, modest and vastly overstated in the press. He figured he could take it. It's not that big. I mean, that is, if he was gentle. Too late. All right, milkweed, now I'm going to give you something, and you're going to take it all. Leonardo growled as he bowed back before exploding forward and entering Johnny Depp's copper-hued gristle dimple with a thud that instantly released a methane and clove cigarette-infused baritone fart so strident and so textural that it caused the yurt's muleskin walls to ripple like Johnny Depp's swollen and slightly perforated lower dung ditch. Leonardo, having now forced his vein bayonet into JD's wound from barrel to stock, pressed his testicles flush to Johnny's backside till both their bodies compressed so lightly that Leo's peach scrotum strained and bubbled out from the space between his hips and Johnny's lower back, giving the appearance from behind that both their bodies were trying to blow a pancake batter bubble. Leonardo pulled out quickly to admire his handiwork. Johnny Depp's prone and horrifically bruised anus now resembled a narwhal wound. Oh, God, Johnny grunted. Perhaps this was a bad idea. Go back to being Arnie. And an eerily deft and quick switch, Leonardo called back, "Okay, Gilbert," before slamming his colon plow in for another full sex stride, causing the various types of coit detritus now making a pilgrimage up Leo's shaft to froth, foam, and gnarl at the base of his jack javelin before nestling in his sandy blonde pubic hair, the various fluids causing his dick mane to resemble a Brillo pad that had been used to remove clown makeup. Say, where's Artie now, Gilbert? Say, where's Artie now? Leo shouted.
Oh, God, where's Artie?
Johnny screamed back, gritting his teeth. He's in your ass, Leo exclaimed. God damn it, that's not how mentally handicapped people sound. Leo was about to rear back for another when it should have been his most forceful colon blow. Before he could, the roof got dark. The birds grew silent, the clock hands now spinning as if pulled by an unseen gravity. They both paused, and before either could speak, the roof of the yurt split at its seams and folded back to reveal Mama Grape, played by, of course, the amorphous Peterbilt-sized Texas starlet Darlene Cates, swaying overhead from a crane fitted with a strap apparatus, generally reserved for retrieving bovine from marshes. Or in this case, lowering overweight, panting fuck buzzards into yurts, her auburn hair amongst a freckled acreage of stretch-marked and varicose vein camouflage skin bulged through the rectangle spaces between the white harnesses as if it were the fifth element and Mila Jovovich was reacting to a serious peanut allergy.
I heard there was some sex in here and I'm starving,
Mama Grape wailed. Before being lowered with her primary slit headmost. I say primary slit because by now, Mama Grape had developed several active cat hair infested bed sores that could easily be mistaken for a half dozen or so minor vaginas. Leonardo pulled out of Johnny's him-quim, broke character, and assisted in guiding the crane operator to place the behemoth starless swollen face and mouth over position over Dom's and Depp's increasingly filthy cram kebab. Once settled on the floor, Leonardo went into action behind her, slamming any flesh hinge he could find. While in one vagina, he would aggressively, evenly digit scour any of the other several other bed sore vaginas, attentively answering each one's beckon as if it were an old phone switchboard during holiday season. Up front, Mama Grape went to town slurping and sucking on Johnny's beautiful meat mandrel, pulling and punching the back of her throat till she gagged and coughed up a plastic Dixie cup she'd ingested earlier in the day. Just then, Juliette Lewis burst in. "Hey, fam, who's ready for some licks?" she yelled in her obnoxious rock and roll voice. Everyone stopped, frozen, before Johnny turned his eyes. "No! Get the fuck out of here!" "And if you ever pick up a guitar or make another note of music, I will fucking kill you." As soon as the yurt door closed, the slovenly pheromone mingling resumed, with Johnny trying his best to deny the pleasure this pockmarked rapture walrus was bestowing upon his stump. But he couldn't now, for it was as if his dong had been fed into a blender full of tongues. And the sensation was bringing him to pinnacle. Before he could stop himself, Johnny's hips reared back and pulsed forth strand upon strand of salinated scrotal sap, coating the swollen cheeks and eyelids of this oblong, pugil-gorging ball star. Unprepared, Mama Grape's face exploded forth, gluey jizz as if her eyes and nose were weak rivets in a steam door. Tossing her head back, Mama's center of gravity forced her to teeter and sway back, falling and pinning the still jackhammering Leonardo behind her. Stuck on her back, Leo lay beneath her, deprived of oxygen. Realizing the young star's face was completely submerged in a cellulite ocean, Johnny tried to pull her off the struggling young star, but she was too much to move, guys. Johnny signaled the crane operator, and the immense sodden actor was lifted, grunt grease and acoline fuck fizz dripping profusely from crevices unseen, as if she were a large cruise ship being lifted from the ocean to be placed in its dry moorings. The crushed star lay blue and unresponsive. Johnny quickly began administering CPR. At this point, Leo had been without oxygen for a few minutes. Brain damage was certain. One final breath, and Leo's heart began beating, his lungs pushing, his eyes sprang open, and the same goofy face he'd been carrying all day appeared. "Hey, Johnny!" Leonardo exclaimed. "Well, I'll be goddamn, this is how you would sound if you were retarded." And so film production commenced, Leo earning grand acclaim, perhaps his greatest to date. But that was the tragedy. It was his later films that should have earned him accolades and awards since. For in What's Eating Gilbert Grape, many did not realize he was acting as his true form. But in every feature since, he was a retarded man playing an able-bodied one. Thank you guys very much.
Ben Roy. All right. We're going to vote on a winner. First, I'm just going to remind you of what everybody read. We started with Michelle Buteau with All in the Family, then Mike Burns with Guy Fieri, Mike Stanley with Night Court, and finally Ben Roy with What's Eating Gilbert Grape. So, with your applause, starting with Michelle Buteau, All in the Family. Mike Burns, Guy Fieri. Mike Stanley, Night Court. Ben Roy, What's Eating Gilbert Grape. Tough one. All right, between Mike and Ben. So pick a favorite. It's tense. It's tense in here. First, Mike Burns, Guy Fieri. Ben Roy, What's Eating Gilbert Grape. I think I'm calling that for Mike Burns by a hair, you guys. You're round one champion. Big round of applause for everybody from round one. That was great, right? Thank you so much, guys. Nice work. If you guys could tell two that we need them. Ben Kronberg, ladies and gentlemen, after much debate.
So I was ready. And then I was kind of like eavesdropping on what the other guys were doing. just to get like a sense of my competition. And I realized that I had the whole concept of the show wrong. I thought this show was repetitive, neurotic flan fiction. So what I wrote doesn't necessarily go with the theme that was established and branded by Brian Cook, apparently. That said, it's just words. Blank check. Even the cinematography of Bill Pope wasn't enough to take the glare off of my glasses. I was sitting there watching my favorite movie, Blank Check, starring Brian Bonzel and Miguel Ferrer and Tone Loc. And then I got a text from my funky cold Medina. The satin in her voice let me know that she was more than horny. I was more than horny. I was in fact hungry. I hadn't eaten in hours and my blood sugar was dropping. I couldn't focus on the movie because all I wanted to do was have a heavy meal and fall asleep. With my sweetie pie, of course. I had been away from her more than 2 hours, and I was getting nervous, and I couldn't think, and I was starving, and whenever I get low blood sugar, it's as if I can't make a decision. And when I can't make a decision, it's as though I tend to just sort of get stuck there, as many people do. I'm not sure how you are, but when I'm sitting there thinking about what I'm going to eat, it's not an easy choice. It should be as easy as saying I'm hungry for this, but it's not that easy as far as the mistake of that I've made in many airports and eating in a Mexican joint that I thought was going to be delicious, but in fact it was not delicious. The chips were chewy and not crunchy as they should. And I saw myself as having two options. I could order the delivery, which I never trust because the food passes through too many hands, and plus I still had a sinus infection that would affect my ordering capabilities. And the second option was to actually leave the house, in which I did not want to do that because since an early age I had agoraphobia, and I did not like that option one bit. Leaving the house made me feel like the world was eating me alive and was hungrier than myself, and I couldn't imagine anything hungrier than myself, but when I thought of leaving the world, I could imagine something hungrier than myself. I knew this wasn't a competition between me and the world. I understood that it wasn't a competition like the show that I had seen earlier in the week. It was the most vulgar, disgusting thing I had ever experienced. It made me feel disgusting, like taking 1,000 showers. But that solution was not possible because, in fact, I was very aware of the water crisis facing our country, and that is not something that I felt comfortable participating. And in fact, there are few activities that I feel comfortable participating. And I was never much for large groups or leaving the house. Like I said, I have agoraphobia, and I tend to repeat myself a lot. When I was a child. And therefore never able to acquire the skills necessary to make lasting human relationships with this agoraphobia, I wasn't able to leave the house and actually mingle with the other kids. And so here I was, unable to finish my favorite movie, Blank Check, starring Brian Bonzel and Miguel Ferrer, who you might remember had quite a major role in the 1987 sci-fi action movie RoboCop, starring Peter Weller and directed by Paul Verhoeven, who would later direct 1990's Total Recall, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, who I knew was more intelligent than the public ever gave him credit for, which he proved then by becoming governor of California. But that is neither here nor there. This hunger had my mind racing, unable to focus on the matter at hand, which was, of course, my rapidly dropping blood sugar. What was I to do? I don't know. I have too many options. It's overwhelming. When you go on Yelp, you type in one word, and that word leads to a million words. And in New York City, to simply Yelp restaurants is as futile task as telling a turtle to speed up his story. You know, and I know that turtles don't necessarily speak, but it was used to illustrate my point. That was merely an example, which was getting easy to solve. Wasn't getting any easy to solve. My two options became a million, and I was contemplating taking my own life, and I wasn't sure about how I would even do that. Like, would I use a gun? I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't even know where to acquire a gun. I mean, I'm sure there's a pawn shop with a gun that would be available to me for my price range, but it's nothing that I could actually do without actually having a second thought, thinking that I'm getting the wrong gun, because I've ordered a carnitas taco before, and that has proven to me to be the wrong choice, as I saw the person with the chicken taco that looked better than my carnitas. Where am I here? No one could ever be truly... I couldn't be not 100% sure anyways of any decision, for nothing could truly be quantified with my blood sugar-deprived brain. You understand, and certainly it was more than a hunch. And all I was trying to do was decide on lunch. Oh my God! Why did my mother do this to me? I don't understand. Was it my father? Was it my father's neglect of her that made her neglect me? I did not understand this. And then it came to be that I made up this saying called "Mothers smother and fathers don't bother." And of course, it is a saying that rings true with many people, not just myself. Especially people whose fathers have died. Of course, a father who has passed away does not bother at all once he has passed. That's not saying my mother's. Taught me how to work a microphone, but that's also neither here nor there. I'd recently turned to be vegetarian, and this made my choices more limited, but also my decisions more difficult, as you can imagine, anybody who's ever been a vegetarian. And there were many potential solutions, but for leaving the house, it didn't make it any easier. So, I was willing and able, and I believe that my circumcision was finally catching up to me. I believe that there was nothing that had happened to me in earlier in life that was not echoing right now in this moment. I felt relegated. I had no choice. There was a taco place below me that was responsible for all the cockroach friends I'd ever made. But whenever I went there, it was as though they didn't remember me, even though I had lived in this place for 12 years. But when I finally got to leave the house, I went downstairs, and they were out of my favorite vegetarian dish, so I was forced to order the flan, and it was just, oh my God, I just came.
Ben Kronberg. Either way. Johnny Pemberton, ladies and gentlemen. Get out of here, Johnny. Just stay close, Ben. Oh, yeah. You know, take this one, man.
Okay. I just hope I don't get arrested for this. I really think this is arrest-worthy, especially reading it on my fucking knees here. Okay. Muppet Babies. Muppet Babies. A show I love. Really did love. It was a hot day in Muppet Baby Town. The AC wasn't working. Neither was the... It was a hot day in Muppet Baby Town, and the AC wasn't working. A terrible slow heat that seemed to work its way into every corner of the nursery, big or small. Ralph lay panting on top of his piano, drooling on the keys. Fozzie wrestled with a pair of old rusty scissors, desperate to expose his summer coat. Miss Piggy lay in a wicker chair, her loins wrapped around the only fan in the nursery, powered by Kermit using a modified hamster wheel. Gonzo and Scooter took turns throwing ice at each other. They were babies, all desperate for relief from the heat. just when Gonzo was about to cut off his own blue proboscis as to let out some blood, thinking it will cool him off, Nanny burst into the nursery, her signature striped tights soaked in sweat. But she wasn't alone. A gruff-sounding man wearing thick, crusty boots followed her. Nanny eloquently explained to the repairman how the Muppet Babies, her non-human, multi-talented, semi-retarded baby slaves, were withering in the heat ever since the AC broke. The babies watched in awe as a rare visitor set to work on the AC unit. Nanny watched the repairman manipulate the rusty old machine, occasionally grunting in frustration as he slammed his heavy, sweaty body against the machine. After what felt like weeks for the poor, sweating babies, the AC was fixed. Nanny squealed with delight as the babies, all of them, clapped like seals at a fish feeding. That is, all except Miss Piggy. She was in a coma-like state from heat exhaustion and would probably perish. No matter. No one liked her. The repairman began to put his tools back in his old leather bag when we see Nanny's sweaty stocking fly across the room and land in the bag. The repairman was no first-timer, no stranger to the strange of his clients, so he went to quick work on his second job. He wasted no time grabbing Nanny by the heels, dangling her upside down, her giggling and dripping all the while. The repairman swung Nanny around and threw her under Ralph's piano. This action simultaneously accomplished three things. One, killing Ralph in a flourish of bright pink blood. Two, destroying the piano with a rattle that rang like a failed North Korean missile test over the din of the newly repaired AC unit. And three, exposing for the first time Nanny's face to you. To us, the viewers, and the remaining living Muppet babies who'd never been able to properly view her because of the relatively low angle at which they stand. Nanny was hideous. Not hideous in the way a victim of an acid attack is hideous, but natural, like an old female shark covered with healed scars from years of intense underwater copulation. This shocked the babies so much the animal began to set about the task of eating his own foot. The repairman, however, felt completely different. This was a rough-and-tumble rustler, a man of no name and no expectations, a career vagrant with just enough skills to stay alive. This repairman rustler began to grow in the pants. A strange whooping sound began to emanate from his pants, like a tornado siren. Nanny lifted her head, dazed from the toss. Dazed, but turned like she had never been in her entire life. A fish-like smile cracked across her hideous face, and a stream of hot drool escaped from her maw. Craning her head, she twisted to hear the klaxon sound coming from the repairman's ever-growing loins. At this point, the brown pants began to quiver, the sound growing ever louder. Then, like a dam hit with a cruise missile, they broke open, letting out what could only be described as a moray eel without a face. The eel-like penis cock twisted around, snapped its penis jaws, and grabbed Nanny by the crotch like Kirby Puckett on a pop fly deep into left field. Nanny cried out in ecstasy as a hot gush of fluid spirted from her general area, soaking nearby Fozzie's fur. For an instant, Fozzie was ecstatic, happy to have wetness on his skin to speed the cooling process in the breeze of the AC. Barely an instant after his baby bear smile appeared, did it fade away as he realized Nanny's preponderance of explosive pre-cum was a strong base that melts away hair like Drano in a sink clog. Fozzie began to weep and moan as the proteins of his body slowly unzipped into the sum of their molecular parts. All the while, Nanny staring at Nanny's bare vag, pink like a Miami sunset, its pinkness only upset by a slight trickle of blood coming from the lamprey-like wounds inflicted by repairman's eel cock. Fozzie's scream faded as Nanny's increased. She was being pumped hard by the articulate eel cock of repairman, moaning like crazy, wriggling around in the carnage of Ralph and his piano. She reached around and grabbed the heaviest gauge piano wire she could find and brandished it like a whip, snapping in the air, screaming, "Gonzo, come to me!" Sweet, innocent Gonzo, terrified at the scene of sexual carnage that was taking place before him, began to run. This was not how he envisioned his first time. He wanted to kiss Miss Piggy on the lips, then have her slowly suck his nose. That's all. But alas, he was not the captain of this sexual boat trip to hell. Nanny snapped the piano wire and grabbed Gonzo by the schnoz. She brought him to her face and suddenly changed her tone back to the old sweet Nanny we've always known. "Gonzo, my sweet baby, you are the chosen one. All the other babies, they were just here to help you, to make you the one who flies to the sun and starts the new age of reptilian power. In your heart of hearts, you know this. This is why I made you watch The Matrix so many times by yourself. Now be a good little gonzo Muppet baby and start the new age. Take your nose over to Repairman and sodomize him. Poor Gonzo began to understand it all but one thing. What was this word, sodomize? Tenderly, he opened his non-human Muppet baby mouth and asked Nanny, Nanny, what is sodomize? Ah! Suddenly, Repairman, now faceless but for a glowing orb of pure black, grabbed Gonzo and began to shove him into his rectum repeatedly. Gonzo screamed in terror. Nanny moaned in pleasure. Repairman's eel cock began to quiver. Time slowed. The sky turned black like the fluid in a novelty magic 8-ball question-asking thing. And slowly, in a planetary-like slow motion, Nanny's pink vag zone began to stream lightning bolts of golden pleasure. She came. Repairman came. And Gonzo came for the first time. The new age was upon them, them as one creature, the new ruler of the universe.
Johnny Pemberton, ladies and gentlemen. Keep it going for your final competitor, Mr. Kyle Kinane.
This guy.
Family splatters. Balky Bartakima stood there as Carl Winslow packed up his suitcase.
But Mr. Carl, now that you're moving to the suburbs, I am scared.
Why are you scared, Balky? Asked Carl sensitively.
I am scared that perhaps never again will you cause me to do the dance of joy.
Carl put down a polo shirt he was folding and turned to Balky. You have to realize they were neighbors originally, and that Family Matters was a spinoff of Perfect Strangers. Although, if you don't know that, this whole thing falls apart. Carl put down a polo shirt he was folding and turned to Balky. He grabbed his frail Mediterranean hips and pulled him close to his own ample bosom. Balky, it has to be this way. Look, as long as you and Larry are together, this just doesn't feel right.
But Mr. Carl, he is my cousin, Larry. That is how it is in my family.
He sniffled, wiping away the tears. Maybe one last time. I'm just doing a weird black voice for Carl. Said Carl. As he dropped to his husky knees.
Oh, Mr. Carl, the only way to get this in Meepos is to push the sheepus to the edge of the cliff.
Balky climaxed in a squeal of foreign ecstasy, which is a cross between Yakov Smirnoff being tickled and a deaf person stubbing their toe. Carl choked a bit while accepting Balky's love hummus. Ugh. Stop eating things wrapped in grape leaves, he complained. It tastes like yellow dye number 5. Fucking idiots. That's the Die Hard reference. You guys, yeah. All right, somebody. Jesus Christ, guys. Step it up, audience. Cut two. Carl's pulling into the driveway of his new suburban home. He was ready to continue this lie, the lie of being a proud black patriarch of a respectable black family. This was the suburbs, and these honkies already had the crosshairs on them. This wasn't time to let the man know that he preferred the man. And on top of that, he'd rather have that man slathered in olive oil rather than hot sauce. He sighed at the thought of his fake life, the insincere smile he'd make at his new neighbors, the Urkels. The Urkels were an odd bunch. He never saw much of the parents, but the boy had already made himself comfortable with the Winslows. An obnoxious but seemingly harmless child, Steve Urkel was a misunderstood outcast with an odd, almost erotic, nasally voice. Carl found himself eyeing this lithe young body while they moved in. His suspenders held his jeans up so high, revealing the tantalizing topography of his new manhood. Steve pined for Laura, Carl's daughter, in such an over-the-top comical fashion. It was almost an open invite to Carl, for he'd known the ruse from his own youth. As a pubescent teen himself, Carl would often don flamboyant outfits and then dramatically throw himself at girls far out of his league. During this daydream, Carl had developed a very real erection. So real that he had to undo his pants. He was swelling up like a burn victim that needed to be cut from his clothes. He looked around for any snooping white neighbors. No rustling curtains or swaying blinds. Fuck it, he thought, as he exposed his nightstick. He started pumping, slowly at first, but purposefully. He was angry at it. Angry at its desire for that forbidden long fruit. This wasn't pleasure that he was seeking. This was punishment. He forced his fist down, punching into his blackberries. And he winced out a fear for that goddamn... fear? A tear. Bad penmanship. For that Meposian temptation that he may never see again. Not with the way traffic is on the Kennedy these days. The local reference always gets it. He pumped for every time that fake Greek would look at him over the fence while he barbecued. For every time he'd go out and get the male naked on accident, because that's the shepherd's way. He'd gone long enough. He realized he wasn't masturbating anymore. He was wrestling secrets back into his penis. It was time to release the pressure and the self-hate and the shame and the years of secrets he kept bottled up inside. This wasn't an orgasm. It was forgiveness. His body shot an apology across the Volkswagen crest on the steering wheel of his Passat wagon. It glazed the face of the six-disc changer. It splashed across the windshield just in time for the waifish Steve Urkel to be walking by. Steve adjusted his glasses to take in the reality of what he just witnessed. Carl, empty of the frustration finally that had been consuming him, knew what he was about to hear. With his still trembling hand, he rolled down his window and, predicting what was about to be said by the flabbergasted Urkel boy, preemptively replied, "No, Steve, you didn't do that."
Kyle Kinane! Stay there, man. Let's get everybody from round two out. Johnny Pemberton, Ben Kronberg. Yeah, there they are. Keep it going. All right. I will once again remind you of what these guys wrote, and then we'll vote. Started with Ben Kronberg with blank check, and then Johnny Pemberton. Hold on. I'm just reminding you, and then we'll vote. Sorry. Ben Kronberg, blank check, then Johnny Pemberton, Muppet Babies, then Kyle Kinane, Family Matters. So, starting with Ben Kronberg, blank check. Johnny Pemberton, Muppet Babies. Kyle Kinane, Family Matters. Round two champion, Kyle Kinane, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much, guys. Let's hear it for all the comics you saw tonight. Michelle Buteau, Mike Burns, Mike Stanley.
That does it for today's show. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes. For details, follow me on Twitter at Brian Cooking or the show at CE Fanfic. See you next time.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.